morning, everybody. Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. It's the John Williams Show, which formerly was the Kathy and Judy Show. There's a lot going on over here, Veronica. It's been a crazy couple of weeks here at WGN Radio. How are you?
Good. We just like to keep everybody on our toes.
Yeah, you know, just got to shake things up once in a while. Keep everybody, you know, happy, unhappy. Stir the pot a little bit.
The only thing constant about change is change.
Yes.
See, we're trying to justify everything.
And that's one to grow on. Yeah, we're very excited. John is coming back to Chicago. He'll be on the air here in a couple of weeks. We're very sad, all of us here, that Kathy and Judy aren't on the air anymore. And I know that's causing a lot of consternation out there. It's causing a lot of consternation with all of us, too. And that's a sad reality of business that I don't know much about. That's above my pay grade. But, God, I love the girlfriends, and I miss them. And Kathy and Judy are two of the best people in the world. And everybody here at WGN Radio loves them dearly. So, with every change, there comes something that you're unhappy about too, I guess. Right, Veronica? Ha! We know that here in this country.
No kidding. No kidding. And like I said, I guess we just have to shake things up. And in this business, none of us are surprised at anything
that ever happens. No, we're not.
And
no,
people who aren't in this business look at us like we're nuts because we're never really sure where we're going to be in two or three years.
No, we're not. The most surprising thing in this business is when things stay the same for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that weird? How has nobody been fired lately? That's odd. And then you start thinking about it. And you're like, oh, God, it's coming.
It could be me.
It's coming at any moment. 312-981-7200 is the number. We're going to have some fun here. We're going to do some serious stuff as well, of course, during the next 2 hours of the John Williams Show. And a little bit, we're going to speak with, this will be a fun one, Seth Shostak, as we were telling Lou from SETI. They found 7 habitable planets. Now, they found thousands of habitable planets in the studies that are being done of the billions of stars throughout our universe. But it's very tough to figure out too much about them because they're so far away. So they started recently looking at dwarf stars. The previous thought was, let's just try to find stars like our sun, and then we'll search from there and figure out what we figure out. But those are all far away. So there's a dwarf star not too terribly far away, which is, you know, relative, because we still can't get there tomorrow. But they found 7 possibly habitable planets within the solar system of this star. Seth will tell us about those and what that even means. Because just because we found a planet that possibly could have water doesn't necessarily mean anything. Or does it mean everything? We'll find out after 10:30. We're going to speak with Andrew Herman from DNAinfo.com. You know, there are so many stories. And 2017 seemed to really pick up where 2016 left off here in Chicago as far as shootings and murders and gang violence and insanity. Or carnage, as President Trump would call it. So it's not gotten any better here in Chicago. And while we need to talk about that and we need to deal with that and not walk away from that, we also need to feel good about our city sometimes, too. So Andrew will share DNA put together 5 stories that will make you feel good about Chicago right now and the town that you live in. And after 11:30, Julia McFarlane is a producer and reporter for BBC over in London. And she's going to jump on the phone with us because I want to hear what the take is overseas right now of kind of the craziness going on here in America. We've got a new administration, new sheriff in town. A lot of things are changing. And we're talking a lot about America, of course, but that's affecting the whole world. And so we'll get a view from overseas on what they're thinking about us right now. The most interesting story I saw this week, and it didn't get a ton of play. There's so much going on here that overseas stories maybe aren't getting as much as they normally would. But there is a French election coming up. And Marine Le Pen is a female running for the presidency of France. And she's been described in the stories I'm reading as a little Trump-like, very nationalistic, very about French first. And when you think about it, in France, you know, they've had terror attacks. They've dealt with this more directly, I would say, than we have. We're very concerned about it. We talk about it a lot, especially with the new administration. But we haven't had a radical Islamic terror attack. I know you could argue piecemeal about some of the different attacks we had and how you categorize those. But we haven't had what France has had, right? And so there's a very combative election coming up. And Marine Le Pen has, they've instituted some bans over in France on headscarves and burqas. There was a big deal about the burkinis and whether those were banned. And then that ban was overturned in some French towns. But there's a lot going on with the burqa and the niqab and different things like that and whether or not that should be banned. And Marine Le Pen wants to ban all religious symbols from public. And that's very interesting because I think a lot of people who are very concerned about the radical Islam terrorists would say we shouldn't allow headscarves, we shouldn't allow these things. But I imagine a lot of those people would be very upset if we said you can't wear a chain around your neck with a cross on it. You can't worship in public. You know, it's interesting because we want religious freedom, but I think a lot of times we want religious freedom for our religion, right? We hear groups fight for prayer in school and different things like that, but I think that's the same group that'd be very upset about headscarves and the such. So should it all be in or should it all be out? Here in America, I don't think we should ever be banning any religious symbol. It just shouldn't be forced upon you. And that's where the different discussions come in. 312-981-7200. I wonder what you think about this. So Marine Le Pen went to a meeting, and this is very interesting to me because things happen in other elections that would never happen in ours, right? Marine Le Pen went to Lebanon to court Franco-Lebanese voters. And I'm talking to Elif about this off there. I'm like, I don't understand. She's going to another country just to court the people who are like voting absentee. Now, maybe there's enough in another country that it makes sense to do that. But here, you know, the president would never go to France because there's a bunch of expats who are going to vote absentee over there. There wouldn't be enough to waste your time doing that, right? Maybe it's different for France. Maybe there's a huge voting block and it makes sense, or just appearing with the Lebanese government and that helps all the maybe Franco-Lebanese voters back at home who have a better feeling for you. But she went to a meeting. She was supposed to meet with the Grand Mufti, Lebanon's Grand Mufti, during a visit to the country. They say she was told she would have to wear a headscarf. She said she told them she wouldn't wear a headscarf, that this was supposed to be okay. She shows up. They meet her at the door with a headscarf, cameras all around. She refuses to put it on, and the meeting gets canceled. Now, to me, a lot of that plays a little heavily on this is a publicity stunt, but it's also a statement. And it's interesting because we talk about religious freedom and religious symbols. And you are free in this country to wear a headscarf, to wear a yarmulke, to wear a cross around your neck, to do whatever you want. But if you went to a meeting and they said you have to do this, I think we'd be very offended by that. 312-981-7200. We'll take your calls next on 720 WGN. Couple of quick calls on Marine Le Pen and the French presidential election. Hey, Jeff, you're on 720 WGN. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. You guys are awesome.
Thank
by
you,
the
sir.
Way, I have to say that real quick.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Especially with Lou. I'm an old contractor, so everything that he says is golden as far as I'm concerned. So anyway, I hope he's listening.
I don't know if anyway. He is, but he appreciates the adulation. Let me tell you that. I know he loves that you said all those things.
The thing that's wrong with actually the way the country looks at this is I'll use Christmas for a good example. Unless the county, the city, the state, or whatever municipal buildings have every single religion on the front yard, like the Christmas trees and the menorah and all this other
right.
stuff, it's never going to satisfy one or the other. And there's no tolerance one way or the other. In other words, there's always going to be a dominant factor. One over the other. It's about winning a football game. And it isn't about tolerance anymore. It's not. Because if you look at it, it's always been one factor that has to be more over there. Like the religious right always has to rule over to, you know, the gay rights. And the gay rights always has to be better than the religious right. You know, and it's there's times where I want to sit there and say, why can't we get along? Because
Honestly, I think
about tolerance from everybody.
I agree, Jeff. Right? And the problem is, like you're saying, one versus the other. It's when one is trying to stop the other, right? I mean, the religious right would be very upset about gay rights and equality when it comes to things like that. So it's not just, hey, there's room for all of us. It's no, that is wrong and we are right. And that's where the problems come in. And I think, you know, you mentioned unless a town has every single religion covered, but even if they do, there's going to be an atheist group that's unhappy with all of that and say, wait a minute, there's supposed to be separation of church and state. Why is the state promoting any of this?
Well, I was adding them into it too. I didn't say it, but yeah. But here's the thing. The one thing I would say is that how is it affecting you? You see, in other words, the gay rights factor doesn't affect me. I'm straight. It doesn't affect me. The atheist doesn't affect me. You know, you go to church every Sunday if you're religious and you pray to and the thing is, you do your thing. If it doesn't affect you financially or somehow other, It's just the thing that you're looking at. Like when I was growing up as a kid, because I'm a product of the 60s and the 70s, right? Everybody hated long-haired people, you know, the tie-dye shirts and stuff, because I was one of them, right? So everybody hated it because we were, you know, pot-smoking, whatever, freaks, right? So now, and the thing is, it's the tolerance factor, you know, get over it. You know, I just, the way that our country is now, if you look somebody wrong or say something wrong, you're going to get in trouble. And that not should be the way it is. I mean, it's the left against the right. And it's about a football game now. It's about a football game. It's who wins, who's the big dog. And it's got to stop because, be honest with you, this is a serious problem. And I can see if we keep going down this factor, a civil war happening in this country because of it. And it's not about it. I'll let you go, but you guys have a great show.
I appreciate it, Jeff. Thank you so much. And, you know, I think the thing is he talks about everybody needs to tolerate it. How does it affect you? You go to church, you believe in your God, and that's what it is. But I don't know about for everybody else, but when I go to church, there's a lot of talk about what we have to do in spreading the word, and all the churches want to spread what their true belief is and believe that the others are wrong. There's not enough tolerance for whatever we believe in. I think that's a huge problem. John, you're on 720 WGN. Good morning.
Good morning. Love your no-show that you're going to be on for just a short time until John Williams comes in.
For today, I'm here. But thank you, John. I appreciate it. John's just off this week. He'll be back at this time next week.
Good. But I'm glad that you touched on this subject because I need the public to be aware of what is the definition of church and state. And my understanding of the church and state is that any 51 states in the nation cannot have a religious church as their state church. So religious freedom is different from church and state. But everybody mixes in, well, what about separation of church and state? There is a separation of church and state. There is no state in the union that has an official church, like an Islamic state church.
Right.
There's no Illinois state church of Islam or Christianity, but they turn around and they say what they do. Well, that's not separation of church and state. That's totally, totally false. People need to get their definition straight, maybe we can make some headway.
Well, I appreciate that, John, very much. I think that the definition is indefinite, though. I mean, this is church and state, I believe, comes from a letter Thomas Jefferson wrote to somebody. So it's the idea of a separation. There should be a wall between church and state. And while there is no official church for the country or any state, I think that a lot of us believe that the government, in whatever form it is, shouldn't be promoting any religion over another because that is imposing views on people. And I think that is true. Now, listen, I love a Christmas tree as much as anybody else, and I want them to be everywhere because that's what I grew up with and that's what I love. Other people, you could see, you know, if there were menorahs everywhere and no Christmas trees at all of our state government buildings, I'd be like kind of hurt by that, right? I'd be like, come on, dude, where's the Christmas tree? So we need to make more room for everybody. There's no doubt about that one. King John has the day off, everybody. He'll be back at 10 a.m. next Saturday. Matt Bubala here with you for the next couple of hours. If you don't know me, I host an overnight show here, usually every Saturday morning, 2 to 5 a.m. I also fill in at various times when people take a day for vacation. For 10 years, I was John's producer here at WGN Radio. That started 20 years ago this fall, believe it or not. If you've been around with John for a long time, well, we're getting older. There's no doubt about it. Okay, so we've talked about all the other craziness all this week, and we'll get back to it. Actually, a reporter from France will be on with us a little bit later on to speak about Marine Le Pen and the headscarf issue. But right now, I want to talk about a more fun story, a more hopeful story that we heard this week. It came out that, you hear all the time about astronomers studying for habitable planets in other solar systems around the universe. But they announced this week that TRAPPIST-1, a dwarf star about 40 light years from Earth, has possibly up to 7 habitable planets orbiting right now. And scientists are studying, trying to find out more. Seth Shostak is a senior astronomer with SETI, and he joins us on the phone. Hey, Seth, how are you?
Just fine, Matt. Good to talk with you on a cold morning for you.
It is a cold morning for us. And after we had 70-degree temperatures last week, it's quite a slap in the face to be back to this. Now, let's jump right to the planets. How cold would it be on these planets? Do we know any stuff like that yet?
No, we don't, because what really counts in a situation like this are two things. One, how far are the planets from their home star, which is, by the way, a really dim bulb of a star. It's about 2,000 times dimmer than our own sun, so it's pretty weak. But these planets are very close to it. They're really star huggers. And as a consequence, the temperatures could be just as salubrious as they are in Chicago. Depends on whether they have an atmosphere. That's the second factor. And we don't know whether they have atmospheres. But if they do, it could be a nice day on some of those worlds, maybe all of those worlds.
All right. Now, how do you figure stuff like that out? It's 40 light years away. So how do you determine, I know you can determine maybe how close they are, but how do you determine whether they have water or gases or oxygen, things like that?
Yeah, well, that's very hard, actually. And the way you usually do it is you look for what are called spectral signatures. It sounds a little bit technical, but all you're doing is sort of examining the light that either bounces off these planets or, you know, some of the light from the star will go through any atmosphere of these planets and affect the light that way. Now, if you can measure that very, very slight effect, then you might see, you know, the presence of an atmosphere, maybe even water vapor. That would give you some indication that, you know, maybe they have oceans. But to do that requires a big telescope, bigger than anything we've got. At the end of next year, NASA is going to launch something called the James Webb Telescope. It's an infrared telescope. It works in the infrared part of the light spectrum. But that telescope might be able to see these things. Remember, these planets are about the size of Earth. They're 40 light years away. 40 light years away is, what is that? That's, that's a couple of hundred trillion miles. That's more than I've got on my Honda.
Okay, so by just how dim the light is as this object crosses in front of its star and the immensely tiny variations on that, you determine what gases are in the atmosphere?
Yeah, well, you could in principle. What you have been able to determine, what we, you know, the astronomers who've done this have been able to determine, is when the planet passes in front of the star gets a little bit dimmer. Not much, you know, but a fraction of a percent, that kind of thing. But that you can measure, and that tells you how big the planet is, because if the planet's bigger, it blocks more of the light from the star. If it's smaller, it blocks less of the light from the star. That we know. But the influence of any atmosphere around that planet, that's very, very subtle. That's very, very subtle. That's like, you know, it's like looking at a person walking across a street in downtown Chicago from a satellite photo and trying to determine, well, what color socks are they wearing? It'd be really hard. We can't do it yet.
Okay, so how close can we get with the current technology to figuring out what you've got going on these seven planets?
Well, the only experiment that we can do right now in order to see, gosh, are these just dead, sterile worlds? Mm-hmm. Or is there, you know, kind of a little mini federation of planets going on there? Because, you know, there's seven planets, and they're all about the size of the Earth. That's pretty unusual. I mean, we don't know of any other systems like that. Is to do our SETI experiment, which we have. The SETI Institute has a bunch of antennas, 42 antennas in Northern California. They're all grouped together there. They're playing together like a team. And we've aimed them in the direction of this star system, TRAPPIST-1. We spent a week or two looking in its direction. We swept through a big swath of the radio dial, hoping to tune in their equivalent of WGN. But I have to say, if there are aliens there, they've been coy so far. We'll continue to listen, of course.
So if they're 40, because I'm not good with science, Dr. Shostak, this is why I turned to you. So if they're 40 light years away, how many years ago would any signal they sent had to have left their planet for us to be reading it with our telescopes right now?
Well, that's the definition of a light year. It's the distance light travels in 1 year. So, yeah, if they send a signal to us, you know, hey, we're the Klingons, we'd like to get in touch, right? It would take 40 years to get here, the same as the distance, 40 years, because radio waves go at the speed of light.
They do go, okay.
That's why, you know, the people in the suburbs there hear you almost the same time as the people down there.
So only 40 years. So that's so. But you already have the results back, and we've heard nothing from there.
Right. That's true. On the other hand, you know, Matt, what I find intriguing is you think about it. If anybody out there was listening for us, right, what could they have heard? Well, as it turns out, AM radio, they couldn't hear, lamentably perhaps, but they couldn't because AM radio tends to bounce off the atmosphere of our own planet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But beginning during the Second World War, we had things like radar and television. and that could reach them. So how long has it been since the Second World War? Well, I don't know, 72 years or something like that. So that's almost enough time for a signal to have gotten there. They pick it up. They pick up that early TV or radar from the war, and they send a message back, hey, you know, we're the inhabitants of TRAPPIST-1, and we want you to buy our used cars, or whatever they're going to send back. And that would take another 40 years to get back here. So that's 80 years in total, and that's almost the amount of time since the Second World War. So I'm thinking maybe we ought to, you know, kind of intensify our listening efforts.
So, boy, it's interesting because you say that they'd send a message back, but if they were sending messages at all, if they had anything like radar or television signals, you would have picked that up, right?
We could have, but I have to say that television, even irrespective of what influence you may say it has on our society, radio transmissions are not designed to be picked up by aliens. So,
right.
You know, they're not all that powerful. In fact, you know, they're getting less powerful with time because people are going to direct broadcast satellite or they got some sort of cable coming into their homes. So, in fact, if they just had television like ours, we would not be able to pick it up. So you have to hope that either they have a deliberate transmitting project aimed our way, which might not make any sense because they haven't learned about us yet and had enough time to respond, or that in another couple of years we start getting messages, hey, you know, welcome to the Galactic Club, the dues are such and such. So, yeah, that might happen.
We're speaking with Dr. Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute, 312-981-7200. So what I want to ask him next, Stephen Hawking says we shouldn't be searching for aliens, that could turn out really bad for us. I wonder what Dr. Shostak thinks. We'll find out next on 720 WGN. Dr. Seth Shostak is on the phone with us. He's a senior astronomer at SETI. By TRAPPIST-1, a short 40 light year drive away, they found seven possibly habitable planets. Seth, so Dr. Stephen Hawking is not big on the idea of us reaching out and contacting alien life. I know that I'm paraphrasing, but he's kind of said before that could turn out really badly for us. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, he was talking about transmitting, of course. He was saying, hey, look, don't start broadcasting messages to, I don't know, the residents of TRAPPIST-1, if there are any, because you don't know what's out there, right? They might be friendly. They might not be friendly. And if they're not friendly, maybe they would launch their interstellar battle wagons in our direction once they heard from us, because they'd know we were here, of course, and, you know, incinerate the planet or something that would really ruin your whole day. Now, but he was talking about broadcasting, and we're not doing broadcasting. We're just listening, right? So if somebody is driving into the city now and they're listening to this show, right, they don't have anything to fear from you, Matt, because you don't know that they're listening, right? You're not going to jump into their car and start giving them a hard time. So by listening, there is really no danger. But I don't even worry about the broadcasting part, because if we were to pick up a signal from these guys, you can bet somebody would grab an antenna and start, you know, sending their top 40 favorites to the inhabitants of TRAPPIST-1. The thing is, if they're advanced enough to be a threat to us, then they have big antennas and they could pick up that radar and television we were talking about earlier. We've been broadcasting them all the time. We continue to broadcast them. O'Hare Airport radars are broadcasting.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I know some of the concern is like, oh, well, maybe they would come be hostile or whatever. Or maybe they need a planet with a lot of water and here we are. But I would think if they had the technology and the ability to travel to other planets, then they'd find millions and billions of planets probably that have water and things like that. Right. I mean, do you think we'd ever be a threat in that way that they're like, oh, we've got to go get their water. We're going to annihilate them.
Yeah, well, if they want water, there's water all over the galaxy.
Yeah.
There's water all over the cosmos. It's one of the most common compounds. Maybe it is the most common compound everywhere. We kind of know that. Look, if they want water, it's crazy. I've been on panels where we've discussed why would the aliens come here? And there's nothing we've got that they haven't got. And of course, they could save the shipping charges, right? Water's very expensive to move around because it's pretty heavy. And if they really came for the water, they'd just go to one of the moons of Jupiter. There's a lot more water there. Nobody's going to fight them for it. But when you think about what is it that we have that they don't have, there's very little except our culture and maybe our biology. Maybe they'd be interested in studying a few of us. But, you know, most likely they just come for the rock and roll.
Well, what about our planet as a whole, that this is a very habitable planet? And as much as you guys are searching, I really haven't heard once you guys say, you know what? There is like an exact replica of Earth. It's awesome. It's got four seasons and lots of oxygen and beaches of Cancun. We haven't found that planet yet. So maybe they're like, dude, let's take that planet. It's awesome.
Well, it's awesome for us. And to be honest, you can make an argument that Earth is really not as good as it could be. But but nonetheless, look, you know, if there were a planet right next door to us, and there is, call it Mars, that we could possibly, you know, inhabit, it doesn't solve a whole lot of problems for you to have a second world. That only increases the amount of space you have for building condos by a factor of two. That's hardly worth the trip. I don't think that our planet, as a planet, they say, oh, look, some real estate over there. Well, yeah, you know, there's some real estate in Tibet, too, but you're probably not buying it.
Well, what if their planet was dying or their star was about to die? Or I don't know. Come on, there's got to be some reason that somebody go, Earth looks pretty good.
Yeah. If their star is dying, maybe they look around and say, well, the nearest other world that's of any interest is 40 light years away. That's already some distance. They might say that, but you know what? Your star only dies once every many billions of years. I think it'd be really really remarkable if it happened just now. But in any case, whether it happens right now or not, we're not controlling that by listening for signals, of course.
That's true. Okay, so what's your best guess? I only have a minute left. Your best guess, if we found life on other planets, what are the odds that life is very similar to what life is like on Earth? Do you think that it would be more like our science fiction movies and fantasies, that there's all sorts of weird forms of life that could be advanced? Or do you think if we find life, there's a decent chance that it looks somewhat similar to what we have here?
Well, that's somewhat controversial. There's at least one evolutionary biologist in Cambridge in the United Kingdom in England who thinks they'd look sort of like us. I'm not sure I agree with that. All you have to do is go down to the local zoo and look around and decide how many of the inhabitants of the zoo, who, after all have DNA, and mostly DNA that's identical to yours, almost, you know, at least 80% of it is identical to yours. How many of them look like you? Not too many, maybe in the primate section there. But, you know, the rest look like fish or snakes or giraffes or elephants or whatever. There's no reason to think that they would look very much like us. But in the movies, they do. Because,
well, the ones that are driving down the Kennedy right now and are shooting radio waves into space all look like me. So there's that. Once apes start, hosting talk shows, then I'll say, you know what, there's probably all sorts of life that could be like this. But as of right now, what we've got to go on, there's only one type.
I think if the dinosaurs were engaged in this project, they would figure, you know, the aliens probably look like dinosaurs.
But they weren't, were they? They couldn't hack it. They couldn't take it, those dinosaurs. They were soft. They didn't have strong borders, Dr. Shostak. Dr. Seth Shostak, a senior astronomer at SETI, thank you so much for jumping on the phone. I hope we talk again soon.
Anytime, Matt.
All right, sir. Good luck for the search for life on other planets. I want to settle down. The John Williams Show on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala filling in for John today. We're here with you until noon. Thanks for hanging out with us this morning on a blustery day here in Chicago. We're live in the Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. Joining us from France is Elaine Ganley. She's the Paris correspondent for the AP. Hey, Elaine, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I should say this evening by you. Thanks so much for jumping on the phone with us.
Yes.
We were talking.
No problem. My pleasure.
Thank you. We were talking a little bit earlier on the show about Marine Le Pen and the French election coming up and the incident that happened when she was in Lebanon, courting some voters there, and had a meeting where there's some dispute over whether or not they had agreed or not whether she would wear a headscarf, but she refused to wear a headscarf. The meeting didn't happen. And this is very interesting what's going on over there, because they've had some definite issues with religious freedoms and the symbolism and the attire that is worn by different people. And Marine Le Pen, if elected, is calling for a total ban on wearing, I guess, would you say, of religious garments or any religious symbolism in public. Is that categorically correct, how I'm saying it?
That is correct. That is one of the 144 measures in her platform, which was unveiled earlier this month at a big conference she held in the city of Lyon. And it is point number 95. A lot of people skip over it, but it's a very far-reaching point. What she would like to do is extend a 2004 law, therefore already exists, that bans headscarves and any ostentatious religious signs in classrooms, not universities, but classrooms up until grade school through high school. Okay. And that, at the time, took marathon parliamentary debates to get it passed, a lot of resistance. It has now become part of the norm. Then that was followed by a 2010 ban on face-covering scarves in the streets, niqabs and things that some Muslim women would wear, more so in the Middle East normally than in the West, but mm-hmm. they are worn by some here. That is banned in the streets. That passed a little more easily because it is a more, for Western eyes in any event, it is a little more extreme than a headscarf, which is practically a fashion piece for young Muslim women,
yeah.
Fashion streetwear, you know. And I realize that in the United States, one would not blink an eye at it.
Generally not. And
pretty much don't.
And I think I wouldn't even necessarily outright assume a religious orientation necessarily if I saw a headscarf, because it's freezing cold here in Chicago, right? And people, I think that's
you
just, you know, that's kind of
yes,
just a look, right?
Yes, you're absolutely. But in France, where there is a huge Muslim population, the largest in Western Europe, estimated 5 million, and historically, the French have been having there have been tensions historically because the origins are mostly in colonial France back when, and it just simply has not been smooth going the whole way. The majority of Muslims, yes, and they are moderate. And the kind of sticking point for many is that France has a model of integration that is unlike the American model, which is integrate. The French want to assimilate. And that means everyone should not just be in the same pot, but be the same sort of French person that sort of outlaws the concept of some people really look different than others because they dress differently, because they're from somewhere else originally. That does not work with this assimilation model, and it above all does not work with French secularism, a dear value. It's written into the Constitution, and secularism means no one shows any religious signs in public. Religion is a private thing. So even a simple headscarf, as fashionable as it may be for some young Muslim women, and I see, you know, there are different styles, there are even fairs where they sell them, that would fall into a religious symbol, an ostentatious religious symbol, just as the kippah for the Jews, just as turbans for Sikhs.
Yeah.
So.
And what about, so we're mentioning, for here in the West, we're mentioning three of the lesser populated religions. What about wearing a chain with a cross on it?
Well, right. The key word in the 2004 law, which Marine Le Pen now wants to apply universally to the streets, which would mean no headscarves or kippahs in streets, it has the key word is ostentatious.
Right. And what does that mean? How are they defining
that? Right. It's how was it defined in 2004? The thing is, it's a little gold cross or a little gold star of David or a little something that is very discreet would not be considered ostentatious.
How about on Ash Wednesday, I go get the ashes on my forehead and I walk around all day?
Well, you don't see as much of that here.
But would that
I don't know. I don't know if there's going to be a sort of fashion or religious police. They're actually, the police do have orders to arrest women with face covering veils. I think they don't. I have spoken with some in the past, especially when this law came out. They were very uncomfortable. They didn't like doing it.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, there are women from Saudi Arabia who are stopped at the airport because they refuse to take their veils off, their faces. And Saudi Arabia is a place where women do.
Do you feel, Elaine, that this is – so I can understand if it's – you know, it's very different, it sounds like, in France, where secularism rules. Here, we would say more freedom of religion is supposed to rule. So the government shouldn't be promoting one religion over another, but we have a freedom to wear whatever we want and be whoever we want to be in public and things like that. So there's an interesting difference. But do you feel that this is being pushed not as true secularism, but as a way to try to mitigate certain religions? Because it's interesting, you know, Christianity doesn't have an outright ostentatious symbol that we wear all the time. So it feels like it's maybe being heavy-handed towards others.
Mm-hmm. Well, secularism, just to begin with, is designed to allow for freedom of religion. It's a hard concept to grasp if you're not French. Mm-hmm. It is supposed to, it grew out of the wars between the clerics and the Roman Catholic clerics, who were very powerful, and the state. And in 1905, this treaty brought an end to this war. It was a rather brutal thing. And this is now today supposed to guarantee peacefulness among religions by keep it in your house, don't put it outside.
Yeah.
I would not venture to say, what I would say is the 2004 law and the 2010 law was definitely security minded. The 2004 law was widely interpreted as something as targeting the Muslims. Yes. It was widely interpreted as such, and the Muslim population certainly felt stigmatized. It has now, no one talks about it anymore. Marine Le Pen has, it is talked about in that some politicians, notably former Prime Minister Manuel Valls, who just resigned that post to run in the elections but did not make the primary, did not make the cut. He wanted to extend it to universities, the headscarf law ban. Some people want it extended to businesses, even private businesses. It is the secularism is something that has been the cause of a lot of strife, emotional and verbal, in France over the years.
Imagine.
Marine Le Pen's decision not to wear the scarf is very typical of her and her party, her far right party, which targets not only massive immigration or denounces what they call massive immigration, denounces many things, the European Union, the euro currency, NATO, all of these things she wants to do away with. So she wants this is in many ways no surprise. That she would not put on a scarf is absolutely no surprise. And one might wonder that if she had obeyed the rules and put it on, whether people who
her supporters would have been very upset, right? Yeah. Do you think that was Elaine, do you think that was a little bit of a stunt that she knew what would happen? She went there anyways purposely to make that happen and make sure that got news and made headlines?
That's one theory. She denies that, sure, that sort of thing. She noted that she had seen earlier, 2 years, I think, a few years earlier, she had seen but one of Islam's top officials, academic officials in Egypt, and he did not make her wear a scarf.
Right.
So that's her justification. She also said she informed them the day before and they didn't tell her anything and that she was faced with a fait accompli.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, one can certainly think it was good for publicity for her.
Yeah.
She is at the top of the polls right now. She was always number one or two. The elections are in April and May, and something very drastic would have to happen for her to fall from at least a number two position. She's currently number one in the latest polls. However, and interestingly, none of the polls see her in the final round. France has two rounds of elections, the first in April, the second in May. And none of the polls put her in the final round. This has been the case for many years, except for 2002, when her father, the founder of the National Front Party, much more hardline, shall we say, than Marine, made it to the second round, even to his surprise, I would say. The left and the right amazingly joined together to block him from power.
Interesting. Elaine, I've got to get to a break because I've got to go, but this is fascinating, and I hope we can talk again before the elections.
Well, I would be delighted, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Elaine Ganley from the AP. She's the Paris correspondent. Search for her on AP. Search for her on Google. We'll get her Twitter handle and give that out as well here in a minute. News coming up in 10 minutes. Good stories about Chicago, ones you don't hear very often, coming up next on 720 WGN.
Listen, learn, laugh. 720 WGN.
One of the most fearsome fighting forces on the planet has never seen a gun and is outnumbered 1 billion to 1. With algorithms and centrifuges, it fights the most fearsome enemy on Earth, an enemy that doesn't care when it attacks or who it attacks. One of the most fearsome fighting forces on Earth doesn't take lives, it saves millions of them. Armed with tenacity, inspiration, innovation, and support from all of us to battle and defeat disease. Every day, the 140,000 researchers with America's biopharmaceutical companies leap into the unknown to pioneer tomorrow's breakthrough cures. Side by side with brave patients, 29,000 here in Illinois in clinical trials to find the next groundbreaking medicine, one of which may save their life, and perhaps one day, yours. Welcome to the future of medicine, for all of us, where together, we go boldly. A message from America's biopharmaceutical companies. Visit goboldly.com.
Dentist office, may I help you?
Hi, I'd like to cancel my teeth whitening appointment.
Oh, may I ask why?
I found a teeth whitener that works in 5 minutes that I can do from home.
Can I ask what it is?
It's called Power Swabs, and it whitens your teeth in 5 minutes, doesn't leave my teeth feeling sensitive, and it's a lot less expensive than visiting the dentist.
Hi, I'm John Greenhut, the CEO of Power Swabs, and if you want to whiten your teeth on average 2 shades in 5 minutes and 6 shades in 7 days, then try Power Swabs. There's no messy strips or trays that you'll have to leave in your mouth for an hour. Just swab your teeth and you're done. It removes stains on natural teeth as well as caps and veneers. Try Power Swabs risk-free by calling 1-800-201-3158. That's 1-800-201-3158. I guarantee your friends and co-workers will be wowed by your new white smile. Try it risk-free and get free shipping and handling today. Get it risk-free by visiting powerswabs.com. That's powerswabs.com.
My name is Dan, and I'm a former frowner. When my daughter got married, I was afraid to smile on our family photos. I was embarrassed by my bad teeth. So, I got dental implants from Eon Clinics. I just called 844-365-SMILE, and their board-certified specialists gave me the confidence to smile and improved my health. Plus, Eon Clinics cutting-edge technology is all under one roof. You're like I was. Call 844-365-SMILE and start smiling today.
Imagine a world free of lung disease. Help us realize that vision and make a difference. Join me, Dave Ennett, and WGN Radio at the American Lung Association's Fight for Air Climb at Presidential Towers, presented by United Healthcare on Sunday, March 5th. Climb 1, 2, 3, or all 4 towers for a total of 2,340 steps. Take the first step and register today at fightforairclimb.org or call 312-781-1100.
Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. Joining us on the phone right now is my old friend Andrew Herman from DNAinfo.com. Hey, Andrew, how are you this morning?
I'm chilly.
What? It was 70 degrees like a week ago. What are you toughing up, dude? It's Chicago. You thought that was going to last?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the snowflakes that were just kind of bumming me out this morning.
Well, you know what happened? Here's what happened, Andrew. We get to 70 degrees last week, and a friend of mine's neighbor brought out his snowblower and ran it out of gas. Just let it run for an hour and a half. and declared winter over. So we were cursed. You know, we're going to get about 20 inches sometime in the next week or two.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
All right. So, Andrew, all we talk about lately is the problems in America, the consternation over the new administration, or the shootings here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But at DNAinfo.com, you guys came up with a few really good stories about good things going on in Chicago and kind of cobbled them together to give people a little hope for our city this weekend. A stranger committed a random act of kindness in Irving Park. Kids learned about gardening in Rogers Park, and teens worked to change how people see the South Side. What are the good stories that are going on?
Well, you know, there are problems facing the city, and, you know, violence and government debt and all that stuff. And at DNA Info, we have reporters across the city in the neighborhoods, and they do report some of that stuff. We create about dozens and dozens of stories every day, and some are reflect the problems, and some do not. And some, I think, show the positive spirit and the beauty of Chicago. And so we, as you say, cobbled some together and put a headline on it, Five Ways to Make You Smile in Chicago. And we did that on Friday. It's on the website right now. And people loved it, surprisingly enough.
So there was a story about a family visiting from, I think, from Detroit. They came to see the Chicago Auto Show.
Right.
And they they went to a barbecue place called Smoke. And what happened?
Yeah, so this is in Irving Park, Smoke Barbecue at 3800 North Pulaski. As you say, they were visiting the city, and it was a mother and a father and two sons, and one of the sons has cerebral palsy, and they're eating there, and they're enjoying themselves, and they go up to pay the bill, and the cashier says, you don't have to pay the bill. The guy who just left here paid the bill for you. And so it was just a nice surprise. The guy who paid the bill told the cashier, I've always wanted to do something nice like this, and today's the day.
You hear about those things from time to time. I think there's a pay it forward day. But
mm-hmm.
a random act of kindness like that can just change a person's outlook. And how nice that it happened while they were visiting Chicago, too. And so now they walk away with probably a pretty good feeling about the town, at least.
Right. And the father says, you know, even before somebody paid for our meal, we've just been meeting nice people all day in Chicago. And everybody gives Chicago a bad rap, but they had the time of their lives.
Excellent. What happened with the Brother Rice wrestler?
Oh, yeah, this is a great story. This is out of Mount Greenwood High School. A couple of kids, Scott Sierzga and Jacob Schmitz, they met each other in freshman orientation. Scott is kind of athlete. Jacob was kind of a student type. They became very close. Both their parents are in the police force. Now, Jacob got leukemia and died, and so Scott devoted his wrestling season to his old friend, and Scott ended up winning second place in the state championship. And, in fact, the entire Brother Rice team did pretty well down there. But it was just about two different Chicago kids, different interests, but became very close, and it's a very inspirational story.
And finally, let's talk about one that I think is most relevant maybe to the issues we're always talking about. Students at Fenger High School are promoting a hashtag Change the Story campaign to show better parts of Chicago and better stories about Chicago. What are they doing?
Right. So this is in Roseland, and we hear about Roseland all the time for its problems with gun violence there. But these kids are part of the Mikvah Challenge, which is a citywide organization that tries to inform and empower and make active citizens out of teenagers. And as you say, they put together a video called Change the Story. And it's very... it might change your mind a little bit about what you think about people who live in these neighborhoods and young people. They in the video, which is posted on the DNA Info website, you can see them talking just about their lives a little bit and about what they think other people think about them and who they really are. And they do talk about what kind of changes they want to see in the city and what they want to do for their own lives. And one kid says, I want to stand up for what's right. And I want people to understand that there's a lot of us out here in these neighborhoods that you might see, you know, sort of glimpses of on the evening news when something terrible happens. But there's other kinds of people who live there, too. And it's just a way for them to sort of get out their message.
All the stories that are hard-hitting and tough to take are at DNAinfo.com. But they've got a lot of these stories, too. There's better sides of Chicago that we don't get to hear enough about. Find it all at DNAinfo.com. Andrew Herman, thanks so much for jumping on the phone, buddy.
Okay, Matt.
Through the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down.
boys and girls. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. 20 more minutes until we get to Amy Guth and the noon show. Right now, we're talking with Julie McFarlane. Oh, you know what? I didn't ask you, Elif, how I bring up Julie. Do I bring her up on Julia? Do I bring her up on the phone line? Yeah, I bring her up just like that.
Hey, hi, Matt.
Julia, how are you?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. Julia McFarlane is a producer and reporter for the BBC over in London, and she took some time out of her Saturday evening to spend with us. I was tweeting with you today. You went to a rugby match. Is that what you were doing?
I was not at the rugby match, but I was watching it with my friends. They were playing up in Scotland.
Okay.
So I am a Scot removed from Scotland working in London, and I'm very pleased to say we won. I believe we thrashed Wales, so that was good.
Congratulations to you. So it's a good Saturday night for you.
Yes,
excellent.
I'm happy talking to you. I'd be sad and morose if we'd lost, so it's all good.
Well, the sad and morose is kind of what we're going to talk about, though, because there's interesting things going on here in America, especially as it relates to the media. And I wanted to chat with you because I follow you on Twitter and I see what you're tweeting all the time. And I'm always curious to see how we're being perceived overseas and in different parts of the world. And certainly with you working in the media and what's gone on with the administration this week. First, there was President Trump about a week or so ago tweeting out the fake news media failing New York Times, NBC News, ABC, CBS, CNN is not my enemy, is the enemy of the American people. And there was a lot of consternation about that. The administration tried to clarify, hey, he was saying the fake news, not everybody, but they did call out pretty much all of the mainstream news organizations in that. And then just yesterday, President Trump, speaking at the CPAC meeting, again, vilified a lot of the news media, while his press secretary, Sean Spicer, had a gaggle in his office where they excluded the Times, BuzzFeed News, CNN, the LA Times, Political, the BBC, and the Huffington Post, among others. They only allowed a few people in, mostly with very conservative leanings or very friendly views of the administration. What are the thoughts of reporters overseas on what's going on over here?
Well, first of all, just in light of what may be seen as being a ban of certain media, Sean Spicer said, actually, no, we were expanding the pool. We had the pool reporters there, and we decided to expand it to some other outlets. Yes, you point out that many of them were conservative leaning, but there was a lot of alarm raised by that, by the fact that CNN, NY Times, also us as BBC, our America bureau editor, Paul Danaher, released a statement saying that the BBC was seeking clarification on why we were not allowed access, because the BBC has had a representative at all the White House briefings so far, and that's very much been the order of how things have happened. So whether the BBC gets some explanation of why our reporters weren't allowed into that briefing remains to be seen. But yeah, I mean, in talking about what Donald Trump has said about the media, how he's called a lot of media outlets fake news and he's criticized a lot of coverage, I think, as you know, we are in the second month of Mr. Trump's presidency. I think we're getting used to sort of the language that he uses to talk to his people on Twitter, on TV interviews. And that holds a lot of appeal for his base back in the U.S. I would say that here in the UK, he is a politician like no other. Well, I mean, he is a two-month-old politician, of course, because he has had no background in politics. And
right.
That held a lot of appeal for him, of course. And there is certainly an anti-establishment, anti-political elite mood here in the UK. So I think it's difficult to sort of tar, you know, what does the UK think of Donald Trump? You know, a population of 70 million people, there will be, of course, people who think that he's great and that he represents the new age of what politics should be all about, drawing people from different backgrounds. That being said, there have been an awful lot of people taking to the streets in the UK, taking part in anti-Donald Trump protests. These protests, which have been held in dozens of locations throughout the UK since the election, since inauguration, since the enforcement of his so-called travel ban, his so-called Muslim ban. And there's been pretty big turnout for those. It was reported that there were around 40,000 people who marched down Whitehall here in London, which is where government is. And also in major towns such as Edinburgh and Glasgow and Manchester, there were a lot of people taking to the streets and protesting against In particular, the travel ban got a lot of negative sort of responses from people here in the UK.
Was that a stunning sight? I can't imagine a time here in America where we have protested against a leader of a foreign country. Now, the only thing I could think of is maybe down in Miami, protests against Castro in Cuba, because there's such a heavy population there. But I can't imagine anywhere else where we would even... Now, maybe that's our own feelings of superiority, that no other country matters as much as we do, so why would we bother protesting? But you know...
It was interesting. Yeah, no, it was, because there, you know, and it's difficult to gauge the national conversation using only social media, because that obviously a huge number of people throughout the country do not use social media. But it was interesting how affronted a lot of British people were with criticism for how the referendum went. And then, of course, we see lots of Brits out in the street protesting against Trump. So there is a little bit of, you know, going back and forth here. But it was interesting to see these protests repeated. They've taken place several times on several days, and it's usually very difficult to get the British people out to protest, really. There's got to be a pretty big decent reason for people to get out in strong numbers. Now, the anti-Brexit protest that took part in London, and of course London voted in overwhelming numbers to stay in the EU, that numbered around 50,000 people. And the anti-Trump protest, the most biggest one recently, a few weeks ago, which was in response to the implementation of the travel ban. Now, obviously, they're all estimations, but that was reported to be around 40,000 strong. So that is quite interesting. But then, of course, you have London, which is a very liberal, it's a very metropolitan, cosmopolitan city, traditionally votes mostly Labour, which is the left-wing party here in the UK. And so there would be a fair amount of sort of solidarity with similar cities in the US, like New York and the state of California, where there were also a lot of protests. So the protests here were kind of showing solidarity with Americans who do not look favorably upon Donald Trump.
You know, there's a big, a lot of social media stories about the parliament, because Trump is supposed to visit there soon. What do you think is going to happen when he comes to town?
Well, I would imagine that there are several groups who are planning, they're aiming for, they say, they want to make the biggest protests in British history. But of course, there are anti-Brexit groups who are hoping to do the same thing before the March 31st deadline of triggering Article 50. We don't know when the state visit is going to take place, but there is also some... there's not a lot of clarity over whether the state visit of Donald Trump visiting the UK will even take place in London. There's been some talk of whether it might be rescheduled to a different city because of the strength of anti-Trump protests that are likely to take place in London. So, I mean, he'll obviously have to come to London if he's going to visit the Queen. We don't know whether that's going to happen yet. Buckingham Palace have said that they're, you know, they've whether this happens or not, the invitation has been put forward. So, we also had that the petition that reached 1.8 million people who signed a petition calling for banning or cancelling the state visit, which was debated in Parliament. It took a few hours. A lot of MPs who felt very strongly about it took a lot of time to voice their thoughts. But there's a lot of healthy opposition in the UK.
And, you know, we were talking earlier in the show about Marine Le Pen and the French presidential election. Do you think that worldwide, as you're watching more on a worldwide scale elections and what's going on in different countries, we hear about a lot of resistance, of course, as you're talking about in the UK to things like Trump. But do you think that we're seeing more and more politics turn towards a bit more of a nationalism right now?
I think that's certainly in the case in the EU. And there's a number of different reasons, and a lot of academics will have different ideas of why. But when you have a sort of a continental sort of framework, that in order for it to work, it has to kind of stifle down individual the individual sense of nationalism, and the rise of nationalism and the fringe groups who have sort of benefited from that has kind of been as a result of having their own nationalism stifled in the face of a new European identity. So I think that my own personal opinion is that I think that's why we're seeing a lot of fringe parties, parties like the Front National of Marine Le Pen, Britain's UKIP, Alternative for Deutschland in Germany. I think that's why we've seen sort of the rise of those. Also building on a lot of Eurosceptic concerns of people who feel a loss of control. And I think, you know, that loss of control and being swallowed up by greater forces around you in terms of globalization, I think that is something that I think resonated a lot with a lot of Trump voters who feel that they have been left behind with globalization. We watched a lot of what happened with the Rust Belts in the US, and a lot of frustrated voices being left behind. I think there are lots of very similar veins to be found in Europe.
You hear a lot of the consternation with the new administration, among many things, is the contacts with Russia. Who knew what when? What was going on? How nefarious is it? Russia has become a big issue here in the U.S. Are you guys thinking about Russia much at all there in Europe, or are there bigger fish to fry?
No. It is definitely something that's on our radar as a emboldened Russia makes more of a move on the frontiers of Europe, and we saw what happened with the annexation of Crimea, and we see frequent Russian sort of aggressive military posturing, shall we say, with, you know, Russian Navy ships and planes doing frequent sorties or, you know, moving close to European territorial waters. That's been the case for a while. There's also Russia's role in the Syrian crisis as well, and so there's a lot of grappling of whether or how best we should engage or stand up to Russia. So, of course, you know, with the new administration, will that lead to better, more positive relations with Russia? Will Russia be more willing to cooperate and not be aggressive and hostile to the rest of Europe and the wide international community? Donald Trump, if he is able to build on his friendship with Vladimir Putin, would be in a really strong position to do that. It's out of our hands here in the UK, but it is something that from where we sit, a lot of people will be watching very anxiously. And a lot of people will be going on with their day-to-day business and who will think that our relations with Russia are, you know, a matter for, you know, for the politicians, and whether it affects a lot of people's day-to-day working lives is something that it depends on who you speak to, whether you talk to voters or whether you talk to politicians and the media, who, of course, we're very interested in what happens in the months and years to come.
Yeah, well, we've got a very interesting 4 years ahead of us, Julia. There's no doubt about that, at least over here.
Absolutely.
Julia McFarlane is a producer and reporter for the BBC overseas. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. I really appreciate it. I hope we can talk again.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, Matt.
We'll talk to you again. Julia McFarlane. Follow her on Twitter. Very good follow on Twitter to see what's going on around the world at Julia McFarlane, MacFarlana, at Julia McFarlane. We'll talk to her again on the Overnight Show. Amy Guth with the Noon Business Hour coming up next on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, Matt Bubala here for John Williams. Thank you so much for hanging out with me. I'll be back at 2 a.m. next Saturday morning in my usual slot. I believe John will be back here next Saturday. Coming up next with the Wintrust Business Lunch, it's Amy Guth. Hey, Amy, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing good. So you're part of the, what's the AWJ, the Association for Women Journalists here in Chicago, or
yes,
is that national?
I'm president of the Chicago
chapter.
I'm sorry,
you're the president.
I'm the president, yeah, of the Chicago chapter. And we responded to that. You know, we are a nonpartisan organization, but we do always issue board statements in times of anytime we feel like journalism is being restricted or challenged, anytime a woman has been maligned by media, mm-hmm. or a female journalist has been put in peril of
sure.
some, you know, we usually will issue a board statement. So we really quickly issued a board statement yesterday about this, you know, just because we feel that that a free and unrestricted press is such a basic tenet of democracy as outlined in the First Amendment. And so we whipped together this statement and put it out there. And, you know, I think it's I don't expect the Spicer office to respond to us,
sure,
of course, right? But I do think it's an opportunity for other journalists and other journalism organizations to think really strategically about how we respond to in moments like this. You know, there's been a little bit of a second beat conversation today so far about, okay, so the people who were allowed in the room, what did they do to stand up for democracy? And what did they do to the people, you know?
Well, I want to say that I read afterwards that they all divvied it up and started transcribing to give everything to all the other outlets, right? Didn't we read some of that yesterday?
Right, we did. And so I think that kind of information is really important to share and think through. You know, the first time we saw something like this from Spicer, it was so shocking. No one really knew what to do.
Oh, that first night.
The first one. Everybody
was
like,
that was great.
Wait, what?
He just came out at full guns blazing. Like, it was like Scarface. Say hello to my little friend. And he's just like spraying the room.
And everybody was so stunned.
Yeah. It was. But, and so how much of that, I know we got to get to your show. How much of that do you think is on purpose? We're going to divert your attention to these things. Because, you know, President Trump is speaking at CPAC saying all these incendiary things. Meanwhile, Sean Spicer does this. Yeah. Half the conversation. The media has, I believe, fallen a bit into the trap of talking about the media and how they're handling it. And
I was talking about this last night on Justin Kaufman's show about how it is both underreported and overreported. Because on one hand, we're the only ones that care about it as deeply as we do.
Right.
You know, most people, the average citizen, is not going to care about journalism as deeply as a journalist will. On the other hand, I think sometimes it's perhaps weighing on me that the average citizen also might not understand how important that is, like the real role of the Fourth Estate.
Right.
So I think there's that too. You know, at the end of the day, I think it doesn't matter. You know, I think it doesn't matter the why. I think it just matters how we respond to it and what we do and how we behave. If we allow ourselves to fall into pundit wars of what does it mean,
right,
and all that, that's where we fall into danger. But I you know, there was a really interesting piece with a political reporter that had gone through everything, you know, in when Toronto was having these same conversations on a smaller scale about restricting access to press from public officials' offices. And you know, the real takeaway was really that there are other things to do, and now's the time to dig deeply. And all journalism is investigative, but dig very deeply into true investigative journalism.
The problem for the administration, I think, right now is in trying to divert and push aside. There's so much media. Now, there's a lot of bad media these days, but there's just so much media that there is enough people to cover everything.
Absolutely.
And there's more resources on small scales to dig deeper than ever before.
Truly.
So I think this is a tough fight to have for 4 years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think everyone involved will get worn down in that fight, truly.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. The business lunch. What's coming up?
You know, we are going to be talking about a little bit about Uber, because there's a lot going on with Uber these days. It's been kind of an interesting and big week for the tech world and particularly tech culture.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be talking about that. And we're going to be talking about there was a piece in the Chicago Tribune from Blair Kamen about really what it means to plan in the urban planning sense for driverless cars.
Mm-hmm.
And does our current infrastructure support it?
Yeah.
Not really. We have to make some improvements here. So we'll be talking about that a little bit with an architect and architecture professor at Illinois Institute of Technology who's involved in a project that's kind of helping to imagine this and create policy around it.
Yeah.
But we're going to kick things off with Mark Horner from Fairhaven Wealth Management, because it is America Saves Week, because people are apparently not saving enough.
Well, I'm going to have to listen in, I think, on the way home then, Amy, because I'm going to have to take notes, because that's a problem in our house too, that's for sure. Okay, we'll take it away.